From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. 2008 was a banner year for job loss. Reports say it hasn't been this bad since Franklin Delano Roosevelt started his fourth term. And never mind recession, some economists are starting to sound the warning bell of a depression. Will another stimulus package reverse the trends? Here to help us make sense of all of this is our regular economics contributor, Keith Reed. Hi, Keith.
Hey, Farah, how's it going?
You know, things can be better employment-wise, but we just have to forge ahead with this bad news. Unemployment numbers for 2008 came in before the weekend. They are chilling. Worst years for jobs since 1945, read the headlines. 2.6 million jobs disappeared. What's going to turn it around?
It's difficult to say what's going to turn around at this point. I mean, they've thrown everything that they have at this crisis. At this point, when I say they, meaning Washington has thrown everything that it has at this crisis. I mean, we've seen, you saw stimulus packages from the Bush administration when the recession was in its nascent stages. You've seen the Obama administration already begin some work on a stimulus package that they hope to get ready to be signed when he takes office or shortly thereafter. There's been all types of measures. Nothing has worked to get this economy moving, and we're really at a point where this thing has snowballed. If you'll think back a couple of months when we first began talking about this, Farai, much of this started again in the housing market, and then that the cold that the housing market had made its way into general lending markets. That lending seized up. It made things bad in the United States, but it also made things bad for banks around the world. And now we're at a point where it's very difficult to tell where to start. You can't say, well, let's start at housing because it's not just housing. You can't say, let's start at lending because it's not just lending. It's also employment. So what do you do to get it fixed? It's very difficult to tell at this point.
Well, there are a couple of economic indicators that people look at. One of them is how many hours a week people work. And it's now down to 33.3 hours a week. What's happening there?
Well, one of the things that you look at is many people, even though you there's a difference between a salaried employee and an hourly employee, and many people who will get a job and they say, well, you make $80,000 a year, but what you're still a salaried employee. If you look at your pay stub, you'll see that there's actually an hourly rate, and what they do is they divide that $80,000 a year up by an hourly rate. At a certain point, when you talk about those full timers who have salaries that work that way, or when you talk about the many part-time employees that you have in the country, that gives an employer some leeway to cut back on the number of hours that their employees are working. That also gives them the leeway to be able to cut back, even in some instances, on the benefits that you're paying, particularly for a part-time worker. A little anecdote here: I was in a supermarket not that long ago down in Cincinnati, and as I'm standing in line, a manager walked over to the cashier and said, do you want to go home? And the cashier and the manager actually got in an argument because the cashier's saying, listen, you've cut my hours already by about 6 hours this week, and I've got rent to make, and it's time to pay my bills, and I need to be here. Well, how often do you hear people say, when their boss comes to them and say, do you want to go home early? No, I don't want to go home early. I still need to be here, and get into an argument over that. People's hours are being cut back because the employers are trying to find ways to cut costs, but that's having, again, another negative impact on people's paychecks.
I met one guy who's doing very well. He deals with bankruptcies, and that is one of the few job markets where I'm sure the people who work in that field are doing pretty well. Is there anything else going on?
It's difficult to say. I mean, this recession has been so broad, and you do tend to see in some other instances, or in the past you've seen in some other instances where certain sectors have been kind of recession proof, or you've seen many people who have lost their jobs start up new businesses, and you see new business creation and small businesses start to do some hiring. That hasn't been so much the case this time around, again, because so much of this has affected the financial sector, the banking sector, where it's very difficult for any employer or any new startup to borrow. So the best you could say for in terms of where to look for jobs is people have to be flexible. I don't know that I could name any one particular sector where things are going great right now, where it's easier to find a job than another one. But you've got to be flexible. You've got to be willing to move. You've got to be willing to look at career, a different career paths, maybe not what you went to school for, or maybe not even what you've thought you were interested in. Flexibility is going to be the rule if you're looking for a job right now.
So let's move to the issue of foreclosures. Citigroup reached a deal with the Senate that might provide some relief. What are the terms?
Well, essentially what Citigroup agreed to is allowing bankruptcy court judges to modify the terms of some of their mortgages held by their borrowers in the instance that person would file for bankruptcy. Banks had been very, very loath to say this, and they've made the argument that, A, it would cost them, some money. Sometimes they'd lose principal, they'd lose interest income, and even in some instances, some of the principal that they'd lent to some of their lenders. But at this point, with Citigroup capitulating to this and saying, well, you know, we've got to do this to try to keep some of the people out of foreclosures and prevent having to take possession of these houses and resell them, now you're probably going to see a lot of the other banks agree to it as well. This is probably a foregone conclusion that this is going to be pretty widespread throughout the banking industry. Again, maybe too little too late for many homeowners, maybe too little too late for some of the banks to prevent some of the losses that they might have prevented if this had happened, say, 12 to 18 months ago.
Now, what about this whole program, Hope for Homeowners? Is it successful? That's, you know, the questions are being raised now about whether or not it's actually reaching who it's intended for.
Well, I think it's questionable whether many of these programs out here are actually helping. If you take a look at there was a report that came out recently that said many of the people whose loans were modified in 2008 or in early 2008, those loans, a certain percentage of those people, I think it's about half or a little bit more than half, were delinquent again or were defaulting again, in danger of defaulting again within 6 months or less than a year. That shows that some of the help that's supposed to be there for these homeowners isn't really reaching the right people. Or it might show that in many instances, and I've said this before, that in a lot of cases it doesn't make sense to modify the loan, but in some instances, a lot of people just paid way too much for the house that they bought. A lot of people just, there's no way you're going to be able to modify a loan or put somebody into a program or get somebody lending counseling if they make a $40,000 salary and the house that they were approved to buy cost $300,000 or $400,000. It's just not going to work. It doesn't matter what you do. That person will never be able to make the monthly payments on that house and be able to keep it. So in some instances, the answer is no. The help is not reaching the people that it should help, or even when the help is reaching, the program is reaching the targeted home buyer, it's still not enough to do what was necessary.
What about the local and regional impact of this? I mean, you know, you're in Ohio. What about cities like Cleveland and Cincinnati? Are there any things that they're going through that are similar, for example, to Detroit, or is it more like, California or Florida? What's going on in the state?
Very, very different perspectives from different ends of the state. Ohio broadly has a pretty big concentration of jobs that are related to the auto industry. There are many suppliers and companies that do all types of residual business for the automotive industry, particularly here in the Cleveland area, because Cleveland again is so close to Detroit. And in the fortunes of many people here, it's a very blue-collar town, and in some regards, many of the neighborhoods in Cleveland were already down on their luck because of the loss of manufacturing and the loss of blue-collar jobs. Those that had never come back from decades ago, and today, the fortunes have sort of turned right back around. Cincinnati's a little bit different because Cincinnati is not as dependent on the blue-collar jobs as Cleveland is. Cincinnati, in large part, is a more white-collar town. It has many Fortune 500 companies headquartered in its city center. You look at your Procter & Gamble's, you look at your Kroger's, you look at your Macy's, Inc., all located right in downtown Cincinnati. Some of those companies are able to weather the storm. We talk about a recession-proof company. Procter & Gamble, to a certain extent, is as recession-proof as it gets because everybody has to buy toilet paper. Everybody has to buy deodorant. It doesn't matter whether you have a job or not. You got to have it. Everybody has to have soap. Macy's, not so much. It's a retailer. People are spending less money. That's going to hurt that company a little bit more than it would hurt, say a Procter & Gamble. But overall, Ohio is suffering from a lot of the problems that you see many of the other Midwestern states suffer from: heavy automotive-related job losses. The agricultural sector isn't really doing great. Their costs are up for the farming businesses in rural parts of Ohio, and foreclosures in the urban centers, especially Cleveland and in some parts of Cincinnati, very, very high at this point.
All right, and just really literally a one-sentence answer. We talked to some people on Friday about whether or not they thought the federal government would come to the aid of Michigan and Florida. They said yes. What do you think for Ohio?
I think the federal government will come to the aid to an extent, but it won't be, just like everywhere else in the country, it won't be to as great an extent, and it'll be too little too late. I think they're just trying to play catch up, and whatever they do at this point will not help sort of the natural cycle of this recession turn around any more quickly than it already will.
All right, Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Keith Reed, our regular economics contributor, and you can find more of his financial wisdom online at Keith Reed's Money Corner. He joined us from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are just a few days into 2009, so how are you doing with your New Year's resolutions? One couple from Chicago has resolved to only spend their money at Black-owned businesses for a whole year. They're calling it the Ebony Experiment. Maggie and John Anderson join us now. Welcome to News and Notes.
Hello, Farai.
Hi, Farai.
So, Maggie, let me start with you. What was the inspiration for this whole program of yours?
I have to be honest with you, maybe 6 months ago, this was nothing more than pillow talk between my husband and I. We, both of us are highly educated, successful business professionals. So, and most of our peers and associates are the same. We've worked at the best companies, we went to the best schools in the world. But the other thing about us is that we're from some of the most economically deprived neighborhoods in the country. I'm from Miami, and my husband is from Detroit. We grew up in predominantly Black neighborhoods. And speaking for myself, most of my friends didn't go to college. I grew up in a neighborhood torn with drugs and violence and most of the urban crisis that you still see rampant in Black communities. So what I'm trying to say is we know the deal. We've seen what Black talent and Black resources can do in our lives and our personal experiences. And we see the struggles that Black communities are going through today. We've seen it all. We've seen the plight and the potential of Black talent and Black resources. So something that dominated our discussions is just our frustration with this asymmetry between Black talent, Black resources, and how that's being represented in and reinvested in Black communities. So instead of talking about it so much, we decided we're going to do something about it. And we're going to try to resolve this disconnect, this asymmetry. So we just decided, you know what? We're going to spend all our money with Black businesses and Black professionals and see if we can make a difference with what's going on in the Black community. The reason we decided to make this pledge public is that we're hoping through our story and through keeping this discussion about Black entrepreneurship and Black professionals and Black talent alive, that we can inspire other families to make similar commitments, maybe not as extreme as ours, but say, you know, I'm going to commit to go to black-owned restaurants for 6 months, or I'll do the Ebony experiment for 2 weeks. What we're hoping to do is just keep this discussion alive about black business.
I want to get to some specifics about what you did to prepare, John. So Maggie has laid out the table. What did you guys do in order to get ready to do this?
Well, obviously, we had to utilize several resources to try and line up what professionals and what companies we were going to try and use. And that was a challenge in and of itself. We've utilized resources like the Urban League and, just peers, in our community. I think what the Ebony Experiment wants to chronicle and is chronicling is some of the challenges that we are currently facing, as well as highlighting and dispelling some of the myths around, how easy it can be to find, services and resources within the African-American community, and also highlighting, I think some of the myths out there may be that from a service perspective or, whatever the case may be, there may be some things that are lacking. We want to dispel those myths as well. But, the Internet, other advocacy groups, things like that, that's what we've been utilizing so far.
Give me an example of one thing that was hard to find and one thing that was easy to find.
Well, part of the Ebony experiment is the hunt. That's piece of what we'd like to chronicle, how hard or how easy it is to find a business. But we want it to at least be able to start off on January 1st and hit the ground running. So we know we needed a gas station, a grocery store, a dry cleaner, those basics. And it was pretty tough finding those things for I. We assumed, just because, like I said, we know tons of folks who went to great schools, and we know there's tons of great black talent out there that would be easy to find. It wasn't. There is one black-owned grocery store in all of Illinois. And fortunately, it's only about 18 minutes away, but we found that online. It actually opened in October of 2008. It's a wonderful store, Farmer's Best. The gas station was another challenge. We had a friend of a friend of a friend who knew a gas station owner. We called that friend, and we're connected to the gas station owner. But all of the five locations in the Chicagoland area were very, very inconvenient for us. So we were thinking, oh my goodness, Ebony Experiment's going to fail because we can't find a gas station. But we found a great solution. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
We purchased gas cards from that gas station owner. We sent her a check, and she sent us $200 worth of gas cards. So that's what we're going to be able to do. We can support that black business and still have the convenience of using the gas stations that are closer to us.
So that's some creative thinking right there.
Yeah, and those are the kind of things that we wouldn't have thought about had it not been for this pledge.
When you think about the way that African-American neighborhoods have changed, and you used to have much more economic diversity within African-American neighborhoods, and now, like so many American neighborhoods, they tend to be, all one income level of people. Do you think that has an influence, John?
Well, no doubt about it. And I think, one of the things that drives us is, again, this disconnect and asymmetry and growing chasm between the African-American middle class and, some of the more, poor urban communities. I think, we kind of walk the fine line of, the trappings of success and sort of, forgetting those communities. I think before, when the struggle or the platform was more along social and civil lines, that was what was highlighted. So you had a broader socioeconomic spectrum within ethnic communities, and now we're not seeing that. So, your point is well taken, and certainly, one of the things that we want to highlight in terms of bridging that gap between the African-American middle class and struggling urban communities.
So, Maggie, when you look ahead, what do you think is going to be the impact of this on not just your family, but on the people who are directly in your life, your friends, your extended family?
Everyone we know is excited about this. We believe that our story is not that unique. We believe that there's a lot of black middle-class families, consumers, and investors who want to do more to reinvest in their communities. And they do it through one-offs, you know, donating to a charity, donating to your church, promoting the programs that serve and serve struggling communities. But what we're trying to push out there is why not do more by giving through the money you spend every day. So some of our family members, our friends, they've already made similar Ebony Experiment pledges, you know, again, not as dire as ours, but they're saying, you know what, I'm going to think about that. I'm going to go to Farmers Best. I'm going to go to that grocery store. I'm going to open an account at my local black bank. I'm going to start thinking about what I can do to support the black business owners that I know. I mean, a lot of our friends are entrepreneurs, and just within our own personal networks, we can do so much to infuse wealth into black communities if we just think about it and talk about it. So we're hoping that just through this dialogue and that our story can be replicated within other circles, that other people like us will talk to their families and their friends and, hey, I have a contractor. Hey, I know of a restaurant. Did you know about this guy? Did you know about that gas station? We think that what's happening within our circle can happen all over the country, and together we can infuse millions into black communities.
Well, guys, good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Farai.
Can I mention one other thing, Farai?
We really are out of time, unfortunately.
EbonyExperiment.com.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's
You'll learn everything about the story, and just keep in touch with us that way.
Okay, great.
Thank
we
you
were
so
speaking
much.
With Maggie and John Anderson just days into the Ebony Experiment, and they pledged to buy only from black-owned businesses for all of 2009. They joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. President George W. Bush defends his presidency in his final scheduled press conference, and in two separate incidences, two young unarmed African-American men were shot by police officers. One was killed, the other seriously injured. Our Bloggers Roundtable is here to discuss these stories and more. We've got Anthony Bradley, who blogs at The Institute, Issa Yulin, author of the novel Crystal Morning. She blogs at IssaYulin.com, and Michael D. Cobb Bowen. He's the founder of the blogs at the Conservative Brotherhood. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Farai.
So let's start out with the president who's going out. This morning, the president, Bush, gave the final official press conference. He reflected on the decisions he's made over the past 8 years and what the next president might face.
You know, the President-elect Obama will find this, too. He'll get in the Oval Office, and there'll be a lot of people that are real critical and harsh. And he'll be disappointed at times by the tone of the rhetoric. And he's going to have to do what he thinks is right, Jim. And if you don't, then I don't see how you can live with yourself. I don't see how I can get back home in Texas and look in the mirror and be proud of what I see if I allow the loud voices, the loud critics, to prevent me from doing what I thought was necessary to protect this country.
Michael, loud critics, there have been many, including many of his own party. What do you think of this whole idea of reflecting on the past and trying to deal with it from the Bush perspective, not a man known for admitting to a lot of mistakes?
I think George W. Bush is a man who can look himself in the mirror. He's been remarkably consistent, which is what one of the things that's given his critics so much ammunition. Because he doesn't back down. He's been steadfast. And
Do you think that's a good thing?
I think it's a necessary thing when you're the president of the United States. You can't be wavering. You have to make clear what your policy is, whether people agree with it or disagree with it. You have a whole government to move. And as the leader of the free world, he represents not only his own constituents here at home, but the United States' interests around the world. And it's especially important in geopolitical decisions that he made, obviously questions of war and peace and diplomacy, that he has to be very consistent. You can't say one thing, do another thing, try to quietly message one party and do something else. So he has been consistent in that. But he's also changed in response to criticism. He has changed the main military leaders for the war in Iraq, and he has changed his military strategy in Iraq. Certainly the provisional government that was there went through some changes. So on the whole, I think he's been a remarkably consistent president. He's defended himself and changed when necessary.
Issa, do you think that's enough to be consistent?
I think that his consistency in terms of making mistakes over the past 8 years is what's most significant about this administration. And I wouldn't even call it a consistency because it has too positive a connotation. I would say that he's just been out of touch. It reminds me of when his father was president and that incident when he was in a supermarket and the checkout woman was scanning the items, and he was amazed at the technology because the last time he had gone shopping, he had to punch in all the numbers on those old-fashioned cash registers. I think that, unfortunately, there's been a kind of arrogance with the Bush administration that has led to a stubborn refusal to consider other points of view, and it has gotten us in trouble domestically and abroad. There was something nostalgic and touching about this final press conference, and I certainly felt the sense of, it was sort of a hallmark moment, if you will. It was a time for him to kind of, you know, say his final farewell and argue on behalf of his decisions that he's made. But they certainly have solidified power for a precious few, but at the expense of the people whom he was elected to serve.
Anthony, another thing that the president said during his press conference was that the Iraq war hadn't turned out quite like he'd planned. I think that's a little bit of an understatement. How do you think America would be different if we had not gone to war with Iraq?
Wow, that's a very simple question. You know, it's impossible to know. I mean, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan has certainly affected various aspects of our economy. They've affected how the world has related to one another, actually. And you know, it's impossible for any president to know the contingencies, the future contingencies of any military action. However, it's certainly the case that one could argue that in terms of the morale in the nation regarding our leadership and our military, the lives that have been lost, there would be significant difference in terms of how we function internationally if not for that war.
What do you think, just quickly, Michael?
Well, I think he's prescient and he's saying that, you know, Obama's going to have to face these things. Obviously, George W. Bush didn't come into office expecting 9/11. And I don't think when Obama first started planning his presidential campaign, he expected the economic meltdown. So Iraq is kind of small news now in terms of we used to be outraged at this many billions. Now we're talking about trillions of dollars that this government has to be responsible for. I think in the long term, the Iraq war is going to be a blip, except for the positive things, in terms of its effect on the U.S. Economy.
Well, guys, we're actually going to take a quick break and continue with more in a little bit, including the discussion of what's happening with some of these police incidents, fatal and non-fatal police shootings. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our Bloggers Roundtable. We've got Anthony Bradley. He blogs at The Institute. Issa Yulin, the author of the novel Crystal Morning and a blogger at issayulin.com. And Michael D. Cobb-Bowen, blogger and founder of the Conservative Brotherhood. So I'm going to move on directly to a very tragic story. So early New Year's Day, a young man was shot and killed by a police officer on a subway platform in the Oakland area. The young man, Oscar Grant, was on his way home from a night of partying with friends. The group was apprehended by a Bay Area Rapid Transit police officer, and videotape shows Grant on the ground with his hands behind his back. Then footage shows an officer shooting Grant in the back. Some believe the officer might have meant to use his taser. Issa, what do you make of this incident and the reaction to it?
Well, I was horrified to see the footage that was posted by some of those young people who were on the BART train when this incident took place on YouTube, particularly because I'm pregnant now. It was very emotional for me to watch this young man be shot and killed at such close range when he was clearly lying on his stomach with his hands behind his back, probably in cuffs, though we don't know for sure at this point, as you said. Thank goodness for videotape and the wonders of new technology, because this would be just yet another incident that doesn't get recorded and doesn't get any attention were it not for that new technology. I think that the response in the streets has been certainly interesting, to say the least. There has been reporting from the Bay Area of people looting and destroying businesses, particularly businesses owned by people of color, private property owned by people of color. That's certainly unfortunate. What happens when these kinds of demonstrations arise is that you have voiceless people, silenced people, who, out of rage and frustration, amplify their cries for justice, for relief, for peace in their communities. And this certainly got out of hand. I think, however, a lot of that has to do with our economy and where people are today, the fact that there seemed to be a sort of random looting and destruction, again, of things that belong and businesses that belong to people of color, sort of willy-nilly and all over the place. I think people are very frustrated by gentrification and displacement.
Well, let me get Michael in on this. Do you think that this is the reaction of the protests, which were peaceful and then turned violent? Is that something that ultimately will hurt this area as it tries to cope with this this tragedy?
I think so, only to the extent to which we kind of institutionalize this politics of rage. The politics of rage are always with us on the fringe. But I think there's something where we do a disservice to the black community by assuming that people are always going to be radicalized in this way, and this is always going to be a reaction, because there were community activists, political people, who organized a protest, and you could think of them as a political institution, and some of their members got out of control. And that's the same situation that the police are in. They're there to serve the people as well, and one of their people got out of control. So if in the end this comes out where people say, well, we're going to have to burn this down and no justice, no peace, a mob is not a community, and they don't serve justice any better. So they're going to have to find a way to cooperate, and they're going to have to think about their urban agenda and see if the leaders that they elect are actually responsible to that agenda. I would hope that at the very least people would say, yes, we need more money to train cops so that they'll be better cops.
Anthony, there's another shooting that people are paying attention to. It was hours before the one in Oakland. 23-year-old Robert Tolan was shot in his own driveway by a police officer in Bel Air, Texas, and it's a wealthy white suburb of Houston. Police said that the officer who shot Tolan thought that the Nissan X-Terra he was driving was stolen, and Tolan is expected to survive, but with a bullet lodged in his liver for the rest of his life. Do you think race played a role in that shooting?
It's interesting to ask that question in light of the last story. There's also a story out of New Orleans as well about a brother that was shot there. You know, here we have a situation where you have a black family in an all-white suburb. At late at night, he and his cousin coming back from Jack in the Box, and these policemen obviously may have assumed that these two young men were in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time, and jump to conclusions. I mean, you know, if these two boys were white males driving around the same neighborhood, they may have been pulled over, but they probably wouldn't have been shot in front of their own house, especially when their own parents came out to explain to the policeman, in fact, that vehicle was not stolen. It reminds us again that it really takes a special kind of person to be a police officer. What we need are men and women who have the virtue of temperance, the virtue of self-control, because when situations get tight, we need the kinds of people that have the inner strength to do what's right, not necessarily to react based on one's own prejudicial conclusions.
I almost hate to switch the topic because the last one was something that is so powerful, but I want to take a quick tour of politics, and this is going to have to be a speed round. Baltimore's Mayor Sheila Dixon was indicted on Friday on charges that she accepted illegal gifts while she was mayor and city council president, and those included holiday gift cards that were supposed to be distributed to needy families. The prosecutor says that she used those cards to buy an Xbox, PlayStation 2, camcorder, and other electronics. Issa, this is our hometown we're talking about. What's going on here?
I am befuddled by what's going on here. I think that if our mayor is found guilty of these charges, I hope we don't have another Kwame Kilpatrick where there's this resistance to justice. And I'd like this to be handled quickly. It was interesting to me that Stephanie Rawlings-Blake came out in support of the mayor. She's someone that I know from high school, is actually a cousin of one of my best friends from high school, and she's now head of the Baltimore City Council. Her voice in support of the mayor was certainly interesting to me and gives me pause, makes me want to probe a bit deeper to see what's actually happening here if she's being targeted. But at the end of the day, if this bad behavior is true that the prosecutor has lodged against her, then she certainly needs to step down quietly, and step out of the way. Baltimore is suffering so much, really economically devastated because of this flight to the county of middle-class African-Americans. It's just a void in place in some of our communities, stable families, creating stable neighborhoods. And this kind of corruption, which would be horrifying even in the best of times, in the best of situations, is even more sinister because of the economic plight of everyday Baltimoreans.
All right. Well, just time for very quick comments from you, Anthony and Michael. Anthony, do you think this case is going to be significant and tracked the way the Kilpatrick one was?
I hope so, because hopefully it'll draw attention to the fact that anyone who is black and a mayor of a large city must recognize that they will be under scrutiny, unlike any of their other predecessors, and they should never accept gifts until after their term is over.
Michael.
I think there's something deeper going on here. They're trying to get her on small potatoes. There smells like a larger agenda.
Okay. Well, guys, thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
Rai.
Thank you, Farai.
We were speaking with Anthony Bradley, who blogs at the Institute. He joined us from KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. Issa Yulin, the author of Crystal Morning, who blogs at issayulin.com. And Michael D. Cobb-Bowen, the founder of Conservative Brotherhood. He joined us here at NPR West. When Barack Obama won the presidency in November, many pundits started talking about where the Obama girls should go to school in Washington, D.C. We spoke with Mother Jones reporter Stephanie Mensimer, who urged the president-elect to send his girls to a public school. But that didn't happen. The Obamas decided to send their daughters to the private, prestigious Sidwell Friends School. Our next guest, Damali Ayo, is a D.C. native and a Sidwell alum. Last week, she started a Facebook group called Sasha and Malia, We Got Your Back, Black Alums of Sidwell Friends School. Thanks for joining us, Damali.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And so why'd you start your group?
Well, I just felt like there wasn't a lot of conversation about what it meant to be two young black girls at Sidwell Friends. And I thought we could have that.
Describe what Sidwell Friends is from the perspective of Washington, because it's got a very specific place in the Washington world. So what is that?
Well, it does. I'd say it's probably the most liberal independent school in the D.C. area. It was no surprise to me at all that that's where they chose to send their kids, because it's the place that's going to probably give them the broadest perspective on American culture, right, and education. And as far as the D.C. public schools go, it's very hard to send your children there. I ended up at Sidwell because my older sisters were in D.C. public schools, and when my mom, you know, had me, she just saw this really like smart kid and realized she couldn't put me in that system. And when she put me in Sidwell, ultimately that also brought my two sisters into the independent school system as well.
So what was a moment that crystallized for you what it was going to be like? You were all the way through, right?
I started there in kindergarten and I went through all the way.
So what comes
to mind? They call us lifers.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, that's a long time to spend with in one context. What was a moment that crystallized for you what Sidwell Friends was, for good or for bad or both?
I think the moment that really crystallized it for me was when I was in second grade and the school decided to IQ test all of us. And me and Tom Shacko, this white boy, came out of the two top scores. And that was no surprise to them for Tom. Tom's score was no surprise to them. But for me, the school kind of freaked out and they decided they had to retest me because they just couldn't believe my score was so high. And my mother had to fight that battle and refused to have that happen. And for me, what happened was then my teacher started to kind of pit me against Tom and all of my exercises. And, you know, can you do this math problem? Tom can. And my life became this kind of black girl against white guy competition.
That sounds highly unpleasant.
Yeah, it sucked. And what was really interesting is that, you know, Tom didn't realize this was happening until he was like 20-something, and I told him at one of our reunions.
So you were living in a parallel universe in some ways in terms of how you were able to perceive some of the failings or some of the issues at hand.
Yeah, you know, a black student in a predominantly white school has a very unique perspective, although it shouldn't be unique. It should be something everyone could just see. You know, another great example is that when I started the school, I integrated our doll collection. You know, there were no black dolls there for me to play with as a kindergartner. So my white aunt actually bought me a black Raggedy Ann and Andy to take to my school so I, you know, could play with dolls that represented me.
So when you think about those experiences, you also, I'm sure, got a great education there.
Absolutely. And for me, my family was difficult. So Sidwell was a wonderful refuge for me. So I was loved by some of the best teachers in the world. Absolutely. So it's definitely a 50-50, you know, kind of experience.
So how do you think the school has probably changed since the time that you went there? I'm sure that because you're a lifer that you've stayed in touch on some level with the life of the school.
Yeah, what was very interesting to me is that I went back for, I think, my 10th reunion. I don't remember. It was one of those reunions. And one of the students was reporting an incident where a black student was openly called a monkey by another white student in their community, and how the school, you know, they really didn't handle it well at all. And I thought, you know, that happened when I was in school, when I was in seventh grade, this happened. And how did my school not figure out how to learn from their experience so this never happened again? So although I would like to say that a lot of things have changed at Sidwell or in, you know, private schools or in schools in general for black kids, I think that there's still a lot of repeat mistakes.
Now, when you think about these two little girls or two young girls showing up to school with the Secret Service, et cetera, do you think it will be more remarkable to people that they have this place in the political world than the fact that they're black?
I think there's a great overlap. Man, I wish I had some Secret Service sometimes in that school. I think that's hot. You know, good for them.
Yeah, you have built-in show
rock
and tell.
The service. Yeah, they should rock the security element. And I say that's the first tip I would give them. I think that what they will have is this really interesting confluence between being a living example of how racism is now over because your father is king of the world, and being an example of blackness. I think it will be very challenging for people to try to teach Black history or talk about American culture without kind of being nervous that these emblems of, you know, some kind of progress are sitting in the classroom. So I think there's going to be a really interesting balance for these two girls about how their father is talked about, because everybody's talking about him as the manifestation of Martin Luther King's dream, which is very entertaining to me. And not how do then they then validate that just putting all that on them is a part of the racist system in the first place, right?
Do you think that ultimately a school like this, where you got a great education but you also took your racial knocks, do you think that it's a win for these girls?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the best we can do right now. And I'm really excited because I think some of my teachers are still there. And so I know they will be in some wonderful hands. And it's a great education. It's something I would never trade. I wouldn't trade Sidwell for any other school, for any other independent school, for public school. There's no other place I would rather have grown up, particularly because it is a Quaker education. And just being able to sit, for example, in high school in Quaker meeting once a week with 400 people in silence is absolutely one of the most powerful experiences anyone can have. So I think it's a wonderful place.
Damali, thanks so much for sharing your story.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Damali Ayo, the author of How to Rent a Negro and founder of the Facebook group Sasha and Malia, We Got Your Back, Black alums of Sidwell Friends School. She joined us from the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland.